work around here, and you shall return. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Okay, we're here, as you can tell, for a unique session of the court. And I really appreciate counsel for both sides helping us out with this, not only because it is a little different than the court has ever done before, with the exception of the early court that did telephone arguments. And the other thing is because of the short time that both parties had to respond to the order. And I again want to thank you for that, but there are two reasons for it. Number one, this case doesn't just have whiskers, it has a beard. I think it is the oldest case at the court. I would give you some reasons, but my view is that reasons are just excuses dressed up in finer clothing. And so I apologize to you, and I apologize to Mr. Perkle also. If we have problems, I think we have a telephone backup, and we will endeavor to utilize that. I would appreciate it after this hearing is over if both parties would contact the clerk, or you can expect a call from the clerk, I'm sure, to give your honest evaluation about the effectiveness of this, the propriety of it, the technical aspects, anything you can think of that would cause the court to either continue or discontinue this practice, or to try to expand it or not. The reason that I think this is important is because, unlike Mr. Carpenter, the ability, many lawyers, especially in small practices or that are solo practitioners, don't really have the opportunity to come here and argue a case at our court. And I think it's important that at least there is a reasonable possibility that if a veteran can find a lawyer, even in his state, that knows a little bit about veterans' benefits and knows that this court exists, then I increase the reasonable possibility that the veteran can come to court with his lawyer, and the veteran can actually have, for better or worse, extended communications with his lawyer. So I think that this may advance that end if you think it's important, as I do. So that's another reason why we're doing this. So let me get prepared here with my notes, and we'll begin. I said in my order that there would be 20 minutes for argument. I said that because I wanted to let you know that I will try to keep it to that period of time, but as with our normal oral arguments, I'll be very flexible if you have, you know, things that you really want to say. So feel free to let me know, but I'd appreciate it if you keep your comments, you know, to the point. So, with that, does either side have any questions? I don't hear any. Does either side have an objection to proceeding in this manner?
No, Your Honor. The appellant does not, Your Honor.
Well, thank you very much. The Secretary's counsel will need to speak, turn the microphone to you, so when you you speak, because otherwise I can't hear. Okay, Mr. Carpenter, your turn.
Before I make my entry here in turn, I want to report to the court that I have my cell phone here as a countdown clock. There isn't a countdown clock on the podium. I just want to let the court know that I'm not sure that I had the 5 minutes.
Oh, sure. I'll make sure that we have the countdown clock here, and actually it's already set for 15 minutes now to reserve you time for. So, would before we begin, I'm sorry, who will speak for Mr. Perkle? And this is Perkle now.
Kenneth Carpenter, Your Honor, also appearing as Ms. Glenda Hurl for Ms. Regina Perkle.
Thank you. And for the Secretary?
Reverend Morris for the Secretary, and with me is Deputy Chief Counsel Tom Sullivan.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Carpenter.
May it please the Court. Mr. Perkle died in 2009, 7.5 years ago at the age of 79. Mrs. Perkle will be 88 years old on March the 9th of this year. The Federal Circuit, in its decision, held that the regional office, in implementing the board's finding of clear and unmistakable error in this matter, was required by law to have considered the effects that the Q finding that they made on the legal as well as factual basis of the subsequent rating decisions in this case.
Okay, I'm going to...
Federal Circuit Court.
Feel free to expand on these questions, but I have some questions related to that portion of your argument. Now, as I read the Federal Circuit's decision, they didn't command this court to do anything, and they didn't specify that there was any particular error. The way they stated or phrased their opinion was that a finding of Q changes the legal and factual framework of the claim. Now, are we doing... Okay. What do you believe is the legal and factual, or are the legal and factual elements that have been changed? Let's start with the legal.
The legal elements are the... procedural protections that are afforded under 38 CFR, formally 3.... under the prior version of the regulation and their successor regulations. All of those regulations specifically require that prior to a reduction of a total rating, there must be a specific finding by the regional office that there was material improvement in the ordinary daily effects on the veteran before the VA can proceed to a reduction in a case.
Okay, I understand that. Okay, are there any factual aspects of the framework that have changed?
Yes.
Okay.
As a result of the finding of clear and unmistakable error by the board in the first of three decisions, the factual basis for the second and third decisions in 1960 and 1966 changed because the facts at the time of those decisions were that the VA had rated Mr. Perkle at 70% and 50% respectively. The factual change based upon the finding of Q is at the time of each of those decisions, Mr. Perkle was in fact rated at 100%.
Wait a minute. That's your argument, correct? I mean, what was the date at which the 100% evaluation became effective?
It was restored by undoing the reduction that took place in the VA's November 17, 1952 decision.
Okay.
And it restored that 100% up until the date of the next sequential decision, which was December the 10th, 1956.
Okay, so I cut you off. Go ahead.
Well, at the time of that decision, Your Honor, based upon the finding of clear and unmistakable error, the factual circumstances changed as a result of the legal determination based upon the restoration of the 100% rating.
But your argument, is when the let me make sure I were clear on the facts. When the restoration was from 52 to 56, that took the 100%. That took the 70% rating back to 100%.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, after that, what are the facts that changed, and when did the next adjudication occur?
The next adjudication occurred on December 10th, 1956, and the factual record at that point indicated incorrectly that Mr. Perkle was rated at 70%. Based upon the revision of the 1952 decision, Mr. Perkle, as a matter of law and fact, was rated at 100%.
Okay, let me go back. Okay, when did the 50% evaluation come into effect? When did the priority...
The April 13, 1966 rating decision reduced Mr. Perkle's rating that had been at 50% based upon the 1956 action to 30%.
But let's go back to the 70% to 50%. Okay, so the first Q decision.
Yes.
By the board. Brought the 70% evaluation back to 50% effective in 1956, correct?
Yes. And okay. The implementing decision by the regional office then extended that 100% rating up until the date of the action taken by the next VA decision on December 10, 1956.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
It is Mrs. Perkle's position that as a matter of law, the legal and factual circumstances at the time of that 1956 decision required a reset. And that reset was to recognize that as a matter of fact and law, Mr. Perkle was rated not at 70%, but at 100%. The rating at 100% triggered the protective provisions of the VA's regulations for the reduction of a total rating.
Okay, and that's what you claim as the factual difference.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, go ahead.
The same factual circumstances arise in the 1966 decision by operation of law, because at the time of that decision, Mr. Perkle would have been rated at 100% and not at the 50% that the record showed at that time.
So if your view is that there's a domino effect going forward, I take it.
Well, I'm not sure that the domino effect is quite the right...
Okay, how would you describe it?
Framework. I believe that based upon the holding from the Federal Circuit, the Federal Circuit found as a matter of law that when the board revised the 1952 decision, finding that there was clear and unmistakable error, that it was required at that time to consider the legal and factual effect on the two succeeding decisions that were dependent upon the previously determined rating in the 1952 decision.
But they didn't say it automatically reverted, I mean, that the finding of 100% automatically carried that 100% of finding forward so as to require the application of these, what you call a change of fact and change of law.
No, Your Honor, it did not automatically.
Okay.
What it did change as a matter of law and fact was the rating that Mr. Perkle had at the time of the 1956 decision. As a matter of law and fact, his rating was 100%.
Okay.
That factual event or factual circumstance triggered the protective provisions of the VA's regulation. And that's what the Federal Circuit ordered the board, not this court, but ordered the board to consider on remand and gave specific remand instructions, which were ignored by the board because the board chose to dismiss rather than to follow the order of the Federal Circuit.
Well, that's, I guess, what we get. That's the nub of the question here, it seems to me, is the court's jurisdiction flows from a final decision of the board.
Correct.
Okay. So, and the board, and in this case, the only issue before the board was the 1953 decision, so the board found. Because,
the 52 decision. The queue of the finding was in the 52, not 53, I'm sorry.
Okay. The early 50 decision. But the 66 and 56 decision were not appealed, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so if they're not appealed and they are final, how can the board have jurisdiction over them?
Based upon the finding and holding of the Federal Circuit.
Well, they didn't say that. They just said that the factual and legal framework has changed. They didn't point to any decision. They said the framework has changed and the board should consider that. The way one way to look at that is that the board did in fact consider it, but once again found that there was no jurisdiction, and the board explained why they believed, or the board believed, that there was no jurisdiction. So your argument, as I again understand it, is there was in fact a change of law, a change of fact, and the Federal Circuit's decision required the board to take that view and then to rule on a motion for revision based on the theory that you've just argued here. Do I correctly state your understanding and your argument?
I'm not sure that I can agree with that characterization, Your Honor. I believe that, in fact, what happened was that the Federal Circuit, within their jurisdiction, interpreted the provisions of 38 U.S.C. 5109 capital A, which is the request for revision authority provided by Congress. That specific authority at capital A subparagraph B says that the effect of a revision will have the same effect as though the prior decision had been made at that time. And interpreting that provision in the context of a reduction of a total rating, where there are specific procedural protections afforded veterans that are precursors, predicates that must be addressed by law before a reduction can take place. This court's case law is quite clear that the failure to afford those protections renders that decision void ab initio.
Well,
so,
now wait a minute, you're getting back into the claims process. We're in the Q framework here.
With respect, Your Honor, I think this is part of the Q framework.
Correct.
What the circuit did was to interpret the meaning of the same effect as it applied in the context of a finding of clear and unmistakable error when there was an unlawful reduction for failing to have afforded the procedural protections required by VA regulation.
Okay.
And that it then has an effect, both legal and factual, on decisions that were predicated on the decision that was revived.
Okay, I understand. Assuming that, now you did represent Mr. Perkle at the time the 1952 or 53 board decision was appealed, correct?
At the time it was appealed to the board, was the board?
That's correct. That's correct.
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes,
and the only decision that was appealed at that time, there was a 53, 56, and 66 RO decisions, but the only one of those that was appealed, that where Q was filed in the NOD, was the 53 decision. So there was no Q alleged in the 66, 56, or the 66 decision, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. That was a strategic decision that was made by me, that the effect of revising the first decision would have legal consequences on the latter two decisions, and that as a matter of this court's case law and jurisprudence in this area, that I could not establish Q in either the 56 or 66 decisions because they were decided based upon the facts as known at that time. And it is the revision of the 52 decision that changes the facts and the legal consequences because the rating is restored to 100%, requiring the VA to consider and afford those protective provisions of VA regulation.
Well, I'm looking at Hilliard here, and unfortunately my copies are printed out, and so the pages will not correspond with anything that you have, but one of the quotes from Hilliard is, on appeal, the Federal Circuit stated, when referring to Andre, that failure to raise an issue in a motion alleging clear and unmistakable error filed by counsel before the board is fatal to subsequently raising an issue, in this case, before the Veterans Court. Now, why does that not apply here if Mr. Perkle did not file his motion for revision of the 56 and 66 decisions?
Well, there are two reasons, Your Honor. First, the Hilliard decision deals with a specific board regulation that prohibits the filing of subsequent requests for revisions. The holding in Andre makes clear that that limitation does not apply to regional office decisions. Mm-hmm. The second reason is that the decision that was successfully challenged before the board was to undo the finality of the 1952 rating decision. And then we got a decision from the Federal Circuit that made it a specific holding that addressed the obligation of the board to consider the legal and factual effects on later decisions. The board has yet to do that. To divert into a question of pleading limitations vis-a-vis Hilliard is simply not applicable to the circumstances of this case.
Well, that's one thing we're dealing with here is the definition of finality, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about jurisdiction related to finality or vice versa.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is that the holding of the Federal Circuit modifies the heretofore understanding of finality of later decisions when there is a revision that has both factual and legal consequences as a result of the decision that was revised, based upon the plain language of 5109, capital A, small b.
Okay, now I'm looking at Cook, and it talks about finality again, and it talks about the purpose of finality, and it says that the purpose of the rule of finality is to preclude repetitive and belated re-adjudication of veterans' benefits claims. Now, the failure, and in your argument, the failure to raise a motion for revision for the 56 and 66 RO decisions, doesn't that fit that particular paragraph in terms of a conscious decision to not raise those and as a result continue litigation unnecessarily?
No, Your Honor, because that rule is premised on the initiation of re-adjudication proceedings by the veteran or the Veterans Council. The initiation of revision proceedings applied only to the 1952 decision, and then the Federal Circuit made a clear and unambiguous holding that the Board had business left to do, and they haven't done it. And this notion that there is somehow a bar because there was no pleading misunderstands the holding by the Federal Circuit.
Okay. Your time expired some time ago, so you'll have 5 minutes to rebut anything that the Secretary may want to raise.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, would it be possible for me to at least cover the Reisenstein portion of your question, since we didn't get to that at all?
Okay, and that would assume that we actually get to the issue of when, whether or not it's lawful to do stage ratings retrospectively or prospectively. Okay.
And if Your Honor would rather me do that in rebuttal,
no, that's okay, because the Secretary hasn't argued that yet. And so let's go ahead and hear what you have to say.
The rule of law established by both this Court and the Federal Circuit and Reisenstein concerns the retroactive evaluation of an award of service connection in the first instance. That is not what took place here. There is no evaluation, retroactive or otherwise, of Mr. Perkle's disability. The rule does not apply to reduction cases because the issue of reduction is not an evaluation case, as has been consistently held by this Court. The rule in Reisenstein concerns the exception to the special protection rules that are afforded because of the VA's practice of stage ratings. There is no stage rating taking place here. The decisions at issue here do not involve the evaluation of Mr. Perkle's rating from 1952 to 1988. It involves the discrete consideration of the legal and factual implications of a finding of clear and unmistakable error in the 1952 decision on the 1956 and thereafter on the 1966 decision. This case only requires that the VA consider those two rating decisions which reduced Mr. Perkle's total rating to determine whether or not the provisions of 3.170, 1949, and its successor regulations apply, and if they find that they apply, they must apply them. There is no retrospective evaluation. Therefore, the Board erred in considering and applying Reisenstein.
What is the purpose behind Reisenstein?
To preclude the use of the protections from reduction when there is a retrospective evaluation that covers a number of years and involves ratings that, in the case of Reisenstein, got up to 100% and thereafter were reduced without having afforded the protections.
But in Reisenstein, don't they say that the reason, or at least one of the primary reasons for adopting this rule, is that in a circumstance where 100% evaluation is reduced, the individual has relied on the income from 100% evaluation, and therefore a reduction requires these extraordinary procedures, the finding of material improvement. But where an individual has not relied on a total evaluation of funds, it would be unreasonable to, and it would be a windfall to the individual, to award them a lump sum of money that they hadn't actually relied upon. So isn't that what one of the major decisions in Rising, or major bases for Rising Sun?
It most certainly was, Your Honor. But the difference is, what distinguishes Rising Sun from this case is that Rising Sun involved the evaluation of the disability. And this case does not involve the evaluation of Mr. Risenstein's disability at all. It only involves whether or not the protections under 3.170 and its successors were applicable, and if applicable, what is the effect of applying them under the facts as existed in 1956 and 1960. There is no windfall. As a matter of fact, to the contrary, it is the VA that unlawfully acted in its 1952 decision to take away the benefits that Mr. Perkle was entitled to rely upon, which had now been restored, but restored for only one of the three windows that are in play in this case.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll see what the Secretary has to say about that. You're up.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor asked essentially two questions, and the short answer to these questions is no, the Board didn't have enough. No, this wasn't a case warranting revision, and to the extent that it was required to, the Board did properly address the Federal Circuit's instructions. This case presents as very complex and confusing, but really it boils down to some very basic legal principles and very well-established legal principles. The first is that there's only two ways to breach the finality of a final decision: new material evidence and clear and unmistakable error. The second is that the subsequent decisions in this case, as this Court noted and as the Federal Circuit accepted, are independent decisions. So in order to breach the finality of those decisions, to change the reductions, there has to be a finding of clear and unmistakable error. In order to find clear and unmistakable error and to engage in that assessment, there has to be jurisdiction over that issue. And in order for there to be jurisdiction, there has to be a properly filed motion for revision on the basis of clear and unmistakable error. The Federal Circuit did not confer any such jurisdiction, and the Federal Circuit, as Your Honor noted, in Cook made it explicitly clear that there are only two exceptions to engaging in the analysis of a decision that's already final. And it is not for the courts, including the Federal Circuit, to create any more exceptions. Beyond that, the Federal Circuit could not have created jurisdiction, because again, we are here on a very specific appeal. This Court's jurisdiction is derived from the Board's. The Board had one issue in front of it, and that was the appeal of the, effectively, the implementation of the Board's finding of Q in the 1953, I do believe it was the 1953 decision where there was Q. And that's the only issue up here. The remaining issues, the subsequent decisions are, again, they're independent decisions, and there's no key motion. So the appellant's argument suggesting that the Federal Circuit has in any way changed the legal landscape as to how to view Q is incorrect, but it also contradicts the very clear and well-established principles of law.
Well, the... There are three elements to Q, and the first element is that the legal there that either the adjudicator misapplied the law or didn't apply the law, and that the adjudicator did not have the facts that existed at the time, well, the facts that before the adjudicator. Now, Mr. Carpenter says, as I understand his argument, that, well, wait a minute, the Federal Circuit said, hey, there is a change in the landscape here. They didn't identify what it was, and Mr. Carpenter said, well, it's clear that the law changed, and because the law changed, then, as a matter of fact, there was no application of the material improvement requirement that the law would, that the law, as the Federal Circuit has found, and by regulation, is law that requires material improvement. Now, that was a long question, but did you?
I did, but I believe there are several points to this. And the first is that the Federal Circuit didn't instruct the board to actually revisit the subsequent decisions. In fact, again, it made it clear that that was not to occur, and it makes it even clearer in Cook. What the Federal Circuit instructed was for the board to consider the effect of the regulation on the subsequent decisions. And in doing that, the Federal Circuit didn't do anything novel.
The specific language, or as close as I can remember it, was a statement of fact that the legal and factual landscape has changed. And that was the finding, right?
That is correct.
And then they said, okay, now, board, consider this. And so my question to the appellant's counsel was, okay, what is the change? An appellant's counsel gave an articulate reason for what the change would be. Now, so tell me why his statement of the law is not correct.
Because I believe it puts the cart in front of the horse. The Federal Circuit, again, did not instruct that this was necessarily going to have any effect. And in one of the citations provided to this court was Russick v. Gibson, and the Federal Circuit gives a synopsis description of what it meant in Perkle. And the idea of a change in the factual and legal landscape is because there are some instances where it can create Q in subsequent decisions. But it didn't instruct that there was any jurisdiction over those subsequent decisions.
Why would it send it back? The Secretary said there are some instances where it could affect a finding of Q. What would those circumstances be?
Those circumstances would perhaps be a finding of clear and unmistakable error with respect to the denial of service connection. So now there's a new fact, and if subsequent decisions that became final had denied perhaps secondary service connection based on the flawed assumption that the primary condition wasn't service connected, that would be a change in effect. That would be a material change in effect, but it still doesn't make it relevant to the initial consideration. It's something that the appellants would have every opportunity to raise in a Q challenge to those subsequent decisions. And Your Honor is asking why the Federal Circuit included it in this case. And again, I don't think what the Federal Circuit did was novel. Both Q statutes have built into it the ability of either the regional office, the secretary, or the board, respectively, to, on its own, move to revise a decision based on Q. And that's something that exists independent of the jurisdiction over any particular claim. And what the Federal Circuit did, though, I believe should be read within the context of this case. One, it was directed solely and specifically to this case. And this case, the context, the relevant context, is that the appellant throughout has raised one argument to the agency, to the board, to this court. It was only when it got to the Federal Circuit that the argument shifted. So before the agency, the board, and this court, the only argument was that the finding of Q in the 1953 decision necessarily voided completely the subsequent decision. So I think it was fair to assume that the agency, the board, had not considered whether there was some alternative consequence. But the Federal Circuit also didn't instruct that this, that didn't create jurisdiction over this issue. It simply sent the case back so that the board could consider something that it really would have had no reason to, because, again, the arguments were very directed in one particular way.
Well, if that was the case, if we're talking, I mean, if jurisdiction was that clear, why didn't the Federal Circuit just find that and end the case?
With due respect, it would appear that the issue of jurisdiction was not something that the Federal Circuit considered, and I think that's evidenced most poignantly by the fact that they actually instructed that the board consider the effect of the regulation on both subsequent rating decisions, including the 1966 rating decision. There was no 1966 rating decision because that was subsumed by a 1967 board decision. So I think when viewed in its totality, the Federal Circuit wasn't considering jurisdiction, but rather was the focus was to address the primary argument as to whether a finding of Q in one decision voids the rest. But to make it clear that it doesn't mean that's always going to be the end of the story. And in most cases, on a finding of Q in one decision, the appellant will be free to file a motion to revise based on Q in a subsequent decision. And I think that's very important because the appellant himself acknowledged that he made a strategic decision. Well, he made a strategic decision and ultimately lost. And that's why we're here. Because the appellant otherwise wouldn't have been able to raise a Q challenge now, certainly, to the board's decision and to the RO decision. Whether he can do that still, that exists outside the context of this particular case, although it would appear he certainly couldn't make it against the board decision again. But again, this was a product of his strategy. And that strategy didn't, you know, while he gives reasons why he didn't pursue the appeal, the strategy was still to file those motions in the first place. So whether those were simply premature motions or whether he should have appealed anyway, again, it comes back to that. And that's really what this case is about. It was about strategic decisions and an incorrect belief that the first Q decision was going to void the subsequent decisions, an argument that was raised throughout the course and history of this appeal that the Federal Circuit acknowledged was an incorrect argument, but as the Secretary noted, and it was in the government's brief as well, that it doesn't mean that a Q decision has absolutely no relevance. It might have relevance, and in this case, yes, something did change. This case is simply not the place where the merits of that change are to be litigated, because again, the board was entirely correct when it found that it had no jurisdiction over the inside of those cases. It doesn't. And to be sure, the Federal Circuit
I'm still puzzled by the fact that the Federal Circuit, instead of making that finding, sent it back to the board, which to me is would, and if we followed your argument, seek some sort of advisory opinion. And the Federal Circuit, while their direction was somewhat cryptic, it was saying that this is a pretty important issue, jurisdiction. So why shouldn't that bother me?
I believe that it shouldn't. I believe that the way to reconcile it, again, this is an instruction in this particular case, and whether we regard that instruction as should have been dicta or as should have not been included, it does apply in this case, and that is relevant. But again, the Federal Circuit didn't send it back with any standard. It didn't send it back with any this court got anything wrong. The Federal Circuit simply instructed that the board, in the first instance, consider again two decisions, one of which is not actually a decision, but was assumed by a board decision. So I think when looking at it in the context not only of the Federal Circuit's case law in general, the Federal Circuit's subsequent description of Perkle in the Russick case, and within the context of this case, I think it is most easily read and reconciled by simply instructing the board to consider And if the board were to find that there was a major change warranting or revision in the subsequent decisions, then so be it. The board is at least on notice that there might have been a consequence. But again, that's why it's only directed in this particular case based on these particular facts. And to be sure, again, the appellant would always, at least in the abstract, always have the right to file a motion to revise based on Q. So even in that sense, there is no, and because it's undebatable that those subsequent decisions can only be changed on a finding of Q, the appellant under the statute has the right to move for revision based on Q, and what the appellant is doing now is simply trying to circumvent that that requirement, that burden, to both file a motion and have the right to file the motion, and then to prove the merits of that motion by demonstrating clear and unmistakable error. And
go ahead.
If I would add, and the appellant has made certain arguments explaining why, why the board was wrong in its consideration, but there's no standard associated with that. The Federal Circuit didn't impose a standard as to how to view the merits of the board's consideration, which is further evidence of the fact that it did not find that anything had been done, clearly wrong, but assumed, given that sequence and history of this case, that no consideration was given. And again, that was probably a fair consideration, given the arguments that had been raised. But there's no way to review that merits. And again, regardless of what the Federal Circuit did, the board's jurisdiction is still limited to what was before it. And those subsequent decisions, it doesn't have any jurisdiction.
So it's your view it's your view, I take it, that the board satisfied the direction from the Federal Circuit.
Yes.
Explain how.
That is correct. It properly and correctly dismissed the appeal, but to the extent that the Federal Circuit did give these additional instructions, it engaged in that analysis. We would submit that part of the board's discussion is legally superfluous, but nevertheless, but complies with what the Federal Circuit had asked. But again, the board did precisely what it should have, which was first engage in the discussion of the dismissal of the appeal because it didn't have jurisdiction over anything beyond the 1953 the effectuation of that. To the extent that the Federal Circuit instructed, it engaged in that analysis. But the board was still right to dismiss the appeal.
Okay. If you can move on to the Reisenstein aspect of the appeal.
I don't have too much to add to that because, one, we certainly believe that we don't even get
no.
to...
No, I understand that point. But something we do.
The appellant distinction between stage ratings and a finding of Q is a distinction without a difference in this context. The purpose of the protective regulations is essentially it's income protection. It's prospective income protection, and that was made clear, and that was affirmed by the Federal Circuit based on the Secretary's interpretation of his regulation. And to the extent that there's any doubt as to whether it applies in the context of Q, Hamer, the other decision that we submitted, would certainly resolve any of that doubt. We're talking about the same regulations, the same idea of protection, and it's looking backwards. The appellant has received, or the veteran, I believe, in this case, received the lump sum of money, and this is in no way related to income dependency in the future. And beyond that, unless the court has specific questions, I believe that those cases are very clear on their face.
I don't have any other questions. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. I believe that we covered everything, and that, again, we would submit that the board properly dismissed the appeal, and again, to the extent that it was required by virtue of the Federal Circuit's instructions to consider the effect of this regulation, it did so. If the appellant believes that there is clear and unmistakable error in the subsequent decisions, if he believes that those reductions are improper, his remedy is to try to move for revision of those decisions. Whether he continues to have the right to or whether his own strategic decisions now limit those rights, that is to be determined in a subsequent case, but he first has to move to file. He has to file those motions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
May it please the Court.
I was looking at counsel too. Go ahead.
Counsel for the Secretary has completely mischaracterized what happened in the Federal Circuit and has overlooked what the original appeal that was the subject matter of the board's first dismissal was. The appeal in that case was about the implementation of the board's finding of revision and whether they impermissibly limited the scope of the revision. The Federal Circuit found that they had, that they hadn't finished their job. As I understand what the government is essentially suggesting to the court, is that the Federal Circuit didn't have anything to do other than to write an advisory opinion about what the board might have done. The way I read the decision, on the very last page of the decision, the final paragraph before the conclusion, the court said, "We hold." Now, Your Honor, when the court says, and when this court says, "We hold," that is a legal determination. A legal determination that is both binding on this court and binding on the Board of Veterans' Appeals. It did not say, as the government infers, go down and reconsider whether you have jurisdiction. And basically, the Secretary would suggest that the Federal Circuit was ignorant of the concepts of jurisdiction and knowingly ordered the board to do something that was ultra vires, that was beyond their jurisdiction. And that is simply a misreading, a mischaracterization of what the Federal Circuit held. The Federal Circuit held that the regional office, in implementing the board's finding of Q, was required. Not could have been required, might have been required, but absolutely was required to consider the effects of the Q finding on the legal and factual basis of the subsequent rating decisions, those decisions being the 56 and 1966 decisions in this case.
Didn't the board do that? The Secretary's argument, as I understand it, is, hey, the board did that. It examined these factors. It even went on, even though they believed there was no jurisdiction, to talk about the Reisenstein case. And so even though they came out to a different conclusion that you are arguing, and that and they did a full analysis of this, it just came out to the fact again that there was no jurisdiction. Why didn't they comply with what the Federal Circuit said? I mean, the Federal Circuit didn't make any determination. Go ahead.
They did not comply because they did not do as instructed. As instructed, they were to consider. They considered after they determined that they were going to dismiss because they had no jurisdiction. If they had simply accepted that they were required by the Federal Circuit's order, by this court's order, to implement the Federal Circuit's remand instruction, and made a disposition, then we would be before the court on the merits. We are not before this court on the merits. We are before this court on a jurisdictional question.
And wait a minute. Do you argue that that the legal and factual situations had necessarily changed? Then why doesn't that seem to me to go to the merits? Like you said, the Federal Circuit didn't say a word about jurisdiction. They sent it back down, assuming jurisdiction. But as Your Honor
pointed out in your opening remarks, we are here because of a board decision. You are reviewing the board's decision. With all due respect, the board did not reach the merits of this case because they dismissed saying they had no jurisdiction.
No, I understand.
They had.
But you just...
If they had no...
But you just, as I understood you, you just said, hey, we're not here on the merits. We're here on a question of jurisdiction. Now, that's what I heard you say. I may have misinterpreted it. So, no. If that's the case, we shouldn't be jumping to the merits here.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
I do not believe we have any business talking about the merits.
Okay, fine.
Because the board never reached the merits because they dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. As a result, Mrs. Purple does not have a merit decision. She has a dismissal of her appeal. It is the dismissal of her appeal, just as it was in the previous iteration of this case, the original dismissal by the board. That dismissal was incorrect. The Federal Circuit, if not explicitly, implicitly found that the board's decision to dismiss was incorrect. And this court's affirmance of that dismissal was incorrect.
And you mean the initial affirmance. Because after the Federal Circuit's decision, we didn't make any findings.
That's correct. But the last sentence of the concluding paragraph before the conclusion said, we therefore vacate the decision of the Veterans Court and remand to the board so that it may consider in the first instance. Now, if you're going to consider in the first instance, you do so within your jurisdiction. And that consideration was as part of the implementation of the Q finding, which the board found by dismissing, there was no additional implementation required as a result of the board's finding of Q. That is an incorrect decision of law, as was their decision to dismiss Mr. Purple's appeal and then Mrs. Purple's appeal.
Okay, I understand your argument.
Okay, I have nothing further.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. I'll close right now by, and then I'll greet the Secretary. I'm going to greet you by saying thank you very much, Mr. Carpenter. I appreciate, again, you cooperating with this procedure, and I'll be anxious to hear your comments through the clerk. Again, thank you very much. The case is submitted.
All right.